It's great to be here tonight. It's lovely to see all of you. And thank you, Carol, for inviting me to speak tonight. It was very unexpected, but very well prepared. She asked me a year ago, so well done. Of course, I wrote down my thoughts in the car on the way over here a year later. But yeah, thanks for the committee members for organizing this. And just to point out that we're in a really significant place as well. Ostend is a hard-drinking city, a fisherman's city, but it's also a city with great sobriety. And if you get a minute to just walk around this hotel, there is a beautiful church called Our Lady of the Dunes in English. And that is where Marvin Gaye, the soul singer, used to sing during the year he lived here in Ostend and was getting sober and clean. So I would suggest to take a look at that place because it's a very special place, and I think it sets the scene very well for what we do here at this convention every year. So there's a spirit of sobriety around us, I think, here in this part of Ostend. So I was born in the, by the way, I'm Sarah, I'm an alcoholic. Sorry about that. I was born in the southern part of the United States, the so-called Deep South. And I was actually born to a Methodist family, and there wasn't a lot of obvious drinking in my family. But I would kind of pick up from conversations in my family, from my family members, that I had like a crazy uncle who was an alcoholic, and my great grandfather was the town sort of drunk, angry drunk. So it was in my family, but there was a lot of repression and a lot of kind of secretive sharing information. So that was kind of around me as a young child, but there was a kind of not knowing is a lot of how I found out about alcoholism. I was a bit of an arty, sensitive child, so the Deep South with its beauty pageants and hunting and guns and American football was not exactly a place for me, but that's where I lived. But I felt really out of place as a young child in that environment. But we moved when I was about 7 to a city in the north, and then I felt really out of place again because I had a really... my diphthongs were very long, you know. I'd be like, can I have a crayon? Very long vowel sound. And my teachers would make fun of me, and I took it very hard, you know. And again, I had this sense of feeling out of place, which stayed with me. And in the meantime, my parents, who didn't obviously drink, they were very career focused, especially my father, and they would have a lot of parties at home, or take me to inappropriate parties with a lot of friends. And I started to try alcohol at a very young age. I think I was about 8 when I had my first drink, actually, and they didn't even notice. So I already kind of had a taste for that lifestyle at a very young age. When I was about 10 years old, my father was diagnosed with a brain tumor, with an inoperable brain tumor. And he died within about a year. My mom was pregnant with my youngest sister at the time and had my sister a couple of days after my dad died. And it was a real chaotic, traumatic, people say these days, it was a really difficult situation, especially for my mom, but also for all of us. And it wasn't too long after that that I really found alcohol as my solution, as my solution to that, because there wasn't a lot of talking in my family. My mom wanted to stay. She didn't want to go back to the South where there was a larger family network. She wanted to stay where she was, and so we just carried on. There was no therapy, there was no grieving process. When I was a little bit older, in my early teens, I started drinking. And I remember the first big drinking experience I had, a friend of mine and I stole a bottle of Maker's Mark from my parents' old liquor cabinet, and I drank half of it and I threw up, and my friend stopped. She's like, "We gotta stop," and I just kept drinking it. I was like, "This is great." So I'd like vomit on my face and I'm still drinking it, and my friend's staring at me like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, "This is fantastic." So my drinking was alcoholic from pretty much from day one. But yeah, there was a kind of exhilarating feeling that I had. I really, really enjoyed that feeling of getting to that point and pushing past that point to go to what I thought was the next level, you know. And so that was kind of my early drinking. I also started at that time to, as someone mentioned before, kind of underachieve, but at the same time I started finding, as we do when we're younger, whether we're drinking or not, a talent that I had. And that particular talent was writing and reading as well, especially poetry. And so I, of course, all the writers and the poets that I found that I liked, Jack Kerouac, who died of alcohol-related hemorrhage, Charles Bukowski, Allen Ginsberg, were all alcoholics. But I loved these guys, and I started to win here and there poetry contests in school and things like that. But at the same time I was discovering that, I was also just spending a lot more time with alcohol and making friends who were also heavy drinkers and alcoholics and addicts. So there was this kind of dovetail, and there was a moment where I discovered that, and then there was a moment where I lost it. In any event, I was able to get into university because of that particular talent, and I went off to the West Coast, and I kind of cut ties with my family for a while at that point. And that's where my drinking went from social partying, I mean, you know, falling out of cars and windows and stuff like that, but still getting up and brushing myself off and, you know, going to the hospital and, you know, going, "Ha, great, fun, next day." To, yeah, really lonely drinking. Most people make, if they do go to university, they might make friends at university or people that they have long-lasting relationships with. That was kind of, I was past that point already when I was in my early 20s. I met a boyfriend. I lived in communal housing in the city of Berkeley, and so we had a weed garden, and it was two of my housemates decided to eat naked for the first month that I lived there. There were about 150 hippies living in this place. It was insane. But I loved it. I thought this was freedom. This was California. And I met this really nerdy, nice anthropologist. He was like the only quote-unquote normie in the place. And he basically edited all of my essays for university. It's really embarrassing. And he helped me kind of get through that period, because I was just drinking heavily. I would start drinking at 6 p.m. And pretty much drink through the night, and he would have to wake me up in the early afternoon. I scheduled all my classes so that I didn't have to wake up in the morning and go to class, and he would help me wake up and get to, he was like a nurse to me, a hostage, really. And I mean, but it seems to him, and I have done an amends to him, and he was really gracious about it, as he always was. I kind of wanted him to kick, hit, or spit at me, but he didn't. He's very nice about it. But yeah, he got me through that. I mean, I now know the term enabler, and I don't use it lightly. I don't think he was exactly an enabler, but yeah, he made it happen. And he, after we finished, went off to France. He got a job with the French government to teach in the French public lycée, and I followed him. I actually didn't get the job, but I just followed him. And when I was there, I just approached the school, and I was like, "Hey, you didn't give me this job." And they were like, "Oh yeah, someone didn't show up, so you can have the job." So I taught at this school for a year after I finished university. I had studied German, by the way, so I knew not a word of French. And this was my life planning at the time. But there was this amazing little shop at the end. This is in the Pyrenees, so really far out in the mountains. There was this amazing little shop that sold wine by the vat. And I was like, this is amazing. And I would just go up and get my vat. And I thought I was really classy as well. You know, I was like, French wine. And there was, there's like this swill that they just... There was like a tap, you know, and they just poured it in the vat. And I was, yeah, I would sometimes show up for class. It was like an assistant d'anglais, so I didn't really have to show up. But I got paid a little bit. I had health insurance. I got hit by a car riding my bike drunk in that little city. And I tried to run because I'm American, as you know, and I had... this ambulance came to pick me up, and I got up, and I was bleeding out of head, blood running down my head, and I just started running, and they were like, come back, you know, what are you doing? And I was like, it's going to cost too much. I can't afford this. And they just were like, get in the ambulance, woman, you're bleeding to death. And they got me to the hospital. I stayed overnight. I went back to the flat where we were staying, and I got the bill, and it was like 20 euros. And I was like, shit, I gotta get to Europe. Gotta move over here for good. But anyway, back to drinking and not socialized medicine. These were the low points, because I had no friends, and my boyfriend at the time had no friends either. You know, I had not only taken myself into this lonely, dark place, but I had taken a hostage with me, you know. And this young guy, bright guy, sweet guy, had no friends. And he was really nursing a very ill young woman in the middle of the fucking Pyrenees. Excuse my language, I know there are children here. Sorry. Somehow I returned back to the US. My story is definitely one of geographical. And around that time, several of my close friends were getting sober. And they knew from way before that I was an alcoholic. Like I said, I always drank alcoholically. There was not a lot of gradual progression in my story. And they were like, you need to try this. You're an alcoholic. And for some reason, I was open to it at that moment. Things had gotten really bad, but nothing... I can't really remember which incident it was that really made me go to my first meeting. But I went. I had actually been in when I was younger, because I had to have a card signed because of, I had a DUI. So I'd been to meetings before. I knew about AA. But this time I went with people I knew. And I went to a midnight meeting in Hollywood. I wasn't living there, but I went with some friends. And there was not a sober person in the room. And they made me read the promises, and they all screamed at me. So that's why I wasn't that worried about sharing tonight, because I was like, this meeting in Hollywood was a lot bigger, and everyone was drunk, and they were screaming and throwing things at me. And so I was like, it's going to be fine. No one's going to throw anything at me. And so far, I've been right. I was like, oh, okay, I kind of get these people. You know, they were. I had grown up listening to punk rock music, and a lot of these people were, they were poor punk rockers. The girl I was with was in a band, and so I liked that. I was like, these people are kind of cool. Now, luckily, I didn't stay going to that meeting, because it was it was a good introduction, but it was definitely not a place where you stay sober. I started going to meetings in California, where I had moved back to, and I started to get it. I found a sponsor who was an amazing woman, a few years older than myself, and I remember doing the third step with her and saying the third step prayer in a garden and getting down on my knees, which I really hope I can do again one day. I will be. and just crying. You know, I just cried. And I wasn't necessarily an atheist, but I wasn't necessarily a believer either. I just had never been able to get down on my knees and have humility and just admit that I was powerless and that there might be a higher power. And I found it really moving. You know, it was a really moving experience. I still remember it very well. In any event, geographical's still part of my story. I decided I had no idea what I was going to do with my life, and I decided it would be a good idea to move to Austria. So I saved up money doing a lot of English teaching, and I moved to Austria to start a master's degree because they were free. And I thought, you know, I studied German, what else do you do? And I went to the university and I really didn't speak a word of German. American education systems. But in any event, I started going to meetings there, and I don't know what it was. You know, they do give you sort of advice in AA, and one of them's like, don't really move in your first year. And maybe for me at that time, that probably would have been a good idea, because whatever it was, I did not connect to those meetings at that time. And I stopped going, and I started hanging out with people who drank and used again, and lo and behold, I relapsed after you know, a period of time. And it was rough, yeah. I mean, I'm sure relapses are part of other people's stories, but it was part of mine. After that, I had another realization. I think that third step really did something for me, because I came back. I went back to those meetings, the same meetings in Vienna that had not worked for me, and all of a sudden I saw them differently. And I got a sponsor, and that sponsor said, and here's where the story starts to turn into how it is now, by the way, we're going from that old drunkalogue to the good stuff now. Just so you know, little narrative. But yeah, my sponsor was like, you need to do service. Your biggest problem is you don't do anything. And it's true, I just wasn't doing anything. I was showing up to meetings and I was like, I wanna go. And so she was like, you're gonna do this service position. You're gonna open up Thursday nights, you're gonna put the chairs out, and you're gonna do the meeting. You're gonna chair the meeting. Back then, in Vienna, small meetings, they didn't have a lot of people to do the work, so I probably didn't have enough time, but she just made me do it, and I did it. And lo and behold, I started showing up every week, I got to know everyone there, and it started, the miracle, as much as I hate to use that word, but the miracle started. The program started to work for me because I was working the program. I did the steps with her quite thoroughly, and then I met a very special person around that time who's here tonight, and yeah, after about a year of that, I got married, actually, to a lovely Belgian boy who was living in Austria at the time, and I also took a job as an English literature teacher. And I also got a stepdaughter, and I also got lots of responsibility in laundry, and I had no internal infrastructure for how to deal with that. So I just always think about this really nice china set that my husband had, that his mom had given him, and they're like, half the plates are gone now. Because I just played frisbee with those plates. Every time I got mad, I was like, "Meh!" And a plate would fly across the room. And I was working my best program at the time. Early sobriety was hard, you know. I would have to do, you know, I can't even tell you how many, yeah, amends I had to do for personal object loss that my husband's But that's part of that period in my life that I actually now look back on really fondly, because that was laying the foundations. That was the work. That was, I didn't know it at the time. And I think if you know it while you're going through that, you probably wouldn't do it. It's kind of like having kids. I've got two, you know. If you knew it was, it's an embodied experience, right? Like, so until you actually are in it, you really can't understand it. And that's how early sobriety was for me. It was very painful, and it was very, confusing, and I couldn't articulate it, but I just kept showing up, and I kept doing the service, and I kept doing what Benita told me to do, you know, and I kept going to my work, even though I hated those little brats. And they hated poetry, you know, they hated literature. But, you know, I just showed up. I'm not making this sound very good for the newcomer, but it does get better, I promise. But let's get forward a little bit today. So today I live in Belgium. Today I've been sober for 15 years. And today, a lot of things have come back to me that I lost. And one of those things is actually poetry and literature. You know, I taught it for many years without loving it. I just did it to make money. And now I've started to, after 15 years, I've started to write it again. I can't quit my day job. I know that. But it's something I love, and it's something I lost to alcohol. And the reason I love to do it today, one of the reasons, is because I got it back because of sobriety. And so every time I get a poem published, I haven't had many, but a couple, I think, hey, this is the gift. These are the promises, you know. There's no money in it, not at all. But there is an amazing feeling of, this is what I was meant to do. And because I showed up, and because I put chairs out on Thursday evening meetings in Vienna so long ago, because I come to a meeting like this and rock up and tell my story, I get that back. And it's amazing. So I want to end my talk with a poem, actually. It's not a poem I wrote. It's a poem by a very famous poet called Mary Oliver, and it's called The Journey. Some of you might know it. One day, you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. So with this in mind, I hope to keep running into you all as we trudge the road to happy destiny. Thank you.